This episode that you're about to experience is so special to me. It's one that I've been wanting to do for a long, long time. To make it even better, the conversation includes all of the key bearers in Covina. So we are full circle with all seven of us discussing Hecate as the maiden. This is such an interesting topic, and I hope you very much enjoy our conversation. If you are looking to join our coven and get to know all seven of us a bit better, you can use the links in the show notes to learn more. Hail Hecate. We're going to get started by talking about how Hecate was sometimes described in different ancient texts as a maiden. So there were different words in ancient Greece and Rome that they used to describe maiden. One is kore, which is attributed to Persephone, the innocent Persephone, or the Persephone above ground. But it also has a lot of meanings and was applied to Hecate as well. And then there's another term, Parthenos, which also means maiden or virgin. These are really interesting aspects of Hecate, but they apply to many of the ancient Greek and Roman goddesses. So we're going to be unpacking them for a little while in a conversation. We have a lot of collective cultural baggage around the meaning of the maiden. Sometimes she is venerated as pure and chaste and, you know, to be emulated. Sometimes that becomes viewed as rigidity, that there is something wrong with the maiden for not being sexual, if she is indeed not sexual, because the Greeks and the Romans had their thoughts about that. So this is a really interesting conversation, something I've been wanting to have for a long time. And we've got everybody here today to talk about it. So we're going to light our candles, and I invite you to light your candle and welcome in the spirit of Kore, maiden. This is our Kore sigil. And on the back, I have Margie's amazing Kore illustration. So let's just release our individual and collective baggage with that counterclockwise motion that we have about the maiden. You know, we might even be carrying things from our own youth. Anything like that that comes to the surface, just see it floating off. And now let's cast that circle around us, protecting us and connecting us and helping us to really enter into the mystery of this aspect of Hecate and many other goddesses. Where do we even begin with this topic? I think this is perhaps why we haven't had a conversation like this about Hecate Kore, Hecate Parthenos, because it's so complicated. It doesn't mean what we may have been taught that it meant. So right from the get-go, this requires some unpacking about the difference between the Victorian Christians who translated a lot of the ancient Greek and Latin texts, and how the Greeks and Romans actually understood things. So I think we need to start off with some history. But perhaps, I don't know, why don't we jump into where a couple of the sources for Hecate, where these come from Hecate first. So, Kore is a really interesting epithet. And it actually comes from many sources of Hecate, but as an epithet of Hecate. But at the same time, Hecate, of course, is really connected to Kore herself, Persephone herself, as part of that triad of Hecate, Demeter, and Persephone. So perhaps the source that we probably all know is from the Orphic Hymn to Hecate. So I chose that for our invocation today. So maybe we can just start with this. Lovely Hecate of the roads and of the crossroads, I invoke. In heaven, on earth, then in the sea, saffron cloaked, tomb spirit reveling. In the souls of the dead, daughter of Persis, haunting deserted places, delighting in deer. Nocturnal, dog-loving, monstrous queen, devouring wild beasts, on girt and repulsive, herder of bulls, queen and mistress of the whole world, leader nymph, mountain-roaming nurturer of youths, maiden, I beseech you to come to these holy rites, ever with joyous heart and favoring the ox herd. So to me, this hymn is so evocative of something mysterious and great and sacred. And at first glimpse, it does, if you try to analyze it and go beyond kind of like the emotional, spiritual reaction to it, it's like, this is, Hecate has like lots of powers, but she's queen, she's maiden, she's mistress. And typically, like in our thinking, you know, the mistress is not the maiden. Like, maidens are not mistresses. You know, they're lower ranking. So the word, actually, the Greek word used is chore in this poem. It's not the other one, which is Parthenos, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. So I'm really interested to hear what you all think, first of all, of this hymn in general. Like, do you connect to this hymn in general? Like, does it feel like you're Hecate to you? And then, of course, about, like, how can she be maiden, mistress, queen? Like, how do we kind of unpack this multiplicity?
Well, for me, it's almost like that Hecate is all-encompassing. Mm-hmm. So, yes, she can be maiden, but she also embraces death and that decay so that life can begin again. So it's that cycle,
right?
Which,
you know, a lot of times I'll refer to Hecate as like the older Hecate, kind of before the Greeks, was more of a great mother figure, but the great mother contained the maiden.
Yes.
Right.
Like, I'm so sorry.
No, go ahead.
But in a lot of the newer texts, Hecate is diabolical is not the right word, but it's the one that came to mind. And I don't know why, but she's this darker, deeper aspect of Hecate that is like represented in the media now. She's almost terrifying in how they represent her, and that's not who she is. That is only like a surface level representation, because there are all these layers that if you keep going back, yeah, you finally get to her as, you know, oh, mother. And she is, you know, she is both nurturing and stern, because yes, she will hold your hand sometimes, but you have to do the work, and she will push you to do that work.
That's so true. And, you know, like this idea of maiden of Kore, one note we need to make, of course, is that Kore not only meant like girl or female youth, but it also meant sprout. So it refers to Hecate Physis, which is Hecate as kind of the source of nature or the bringer of nature, which is kind of deeper than, for example, like Demeter being the ruler of agriculture, for example. You know what I mean? Like, it's like Hecate is this, but we're getting to that liminality, right? Like she's not the plant, but she's the force that is this, that makes the sprout grow.
Yeah, that spark of life that begins the like the whole process of the sprout.
Right. And so the word core has all this richness to it that in the English language, calling that maiden or virgin, it gets really corrupted. Does this make sense? Does that make sense, Liz?
Or like diminished. Like you lose the multifaceted nature of what Corey could have meant to them. And the fact that it would have meant those things at the same time. Right? Right. You didn't have to pick or choose. You have this concept of all of those things at once. Yeah.
It meant a bunch of things. And I think, you know, like we've been talking about this a lot, but we do this a lot with mothers. We're gonna have a conversation later about Demeter, but we do this, you know, like it's something about our culture here in the West where it's like, if you are one thing, like you need to be tightly packaged in that one thing. And that one thing can't have like implicitly contradictory but valuable meanings, if that makes sense.
I was thinking about that earlier. And like with context that like we see women as going through stages, like, you know, you transition from maiden to mother to crone, like all of the roles that women take on in that life are like a transitory thing. Whereas like the roles that we give to men, like you've got a hunter or a warrior and they become a father or advocate, like they're allowed to be all of those things at once. They don't, it's not like you have transitioned into, you know, mother and now you cannot go back to maiden.
Because that's all you can be.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a mother, you can't have a, you know, you can't be a mother and have a career, or you're seen as being like neglectful to your family or, you know, power hungry or whatever. You have to stay in that lane. It's very limiting.
Yeah, that's a really good point that we haven't made yet, is that this issue of like how we think of a maiden, it's a woman who hasn't had children or is a virgin, hasn't had sex. And I don't believe like in that Orphic hymn, he wasn't referring to Kore as, you know, someone who never had sex. But that's not what the author was trying to evoke. But I think for like, because we live and like still in the consequences of how the Victorians were so uptight about sex, they were so obsessed with sex, that when we see maiden, there can be a connotation right away, you know, that she's like virginal in the sense that, you know, in purity culture and all that business. I don't know, Alyssa, you had some good notes about purity culture.
Yeah, and I think it ties in a little bit with what I was saying about, like, it's like, you know, once you are no longer a maiden, like, you can't go back. But I was thinking a lot this week, too, about how, like, the idea of maidenhood, like, even, like, when we have, like, a ship that makes a maiden voyage or something like that, like, it is something that is designed to be ephemeral. Like, it is something that is designed to be taken away. And that, like, something, you know, has diminished value when that's taken away. I mean, let's... purity culture in a nutshell is, you know, once you've had sex or, you know, had children or whatever, like you are no longer this desirable ideal that is held up, like you're corrupted and like you can't have that vitality and that youth anymore. Which, I mean, I think the reclaimed maiden, which I think we'll probably talk a little bit more about later, is, you know, just a rejection of that idea.
Definitely. And, you know, it's interesting you bring up this idea of, like, on one hand, impurity culture is, like, not having sex. All those kind of organizations that are about, you know, girls committing to not having sex before they're married or something. But on the other hand, you get the purity culture around if you're a woman and you don't have a husband and children, then you're impure, too. And in the ancient Greeks and Rome, there were competing views about this, just like there is now. You know, there was, in terms of, you know, like the medicine that would have been practiced back then, there were two views. One was that chaste women had better health and better mental health, better everything. But then the other view was that if a woman didn't have a husband and children, then she'd go crazy. So we've got that kind of idea of the maiden too, right? Like the spinster aunt. So
it's idealized like up to a certain point in your life, and then all of a sudden, and I wonder if it has something to do with like when you start to like age out of the male gaze. Wow, does that make any sense for all? Because you're starting to like get to that point where you're no longer like, desirable and you don't have children acceptable, and that's sad. But you know, if you're young and beautiful and like, I don't know, the whole like purity almost kind of gets like fetishized. You know, like even.
No, I don't follow. It's like, go ahead, Kristen.
I know. I would have followed that up with something. In this idea that, I don't know, like virgin to me, being sort of this sense of purity or being annotated and full of vitality and whatnot. But like what you're saying, Alyssa, I think maybe it is sort of like in purity culture, what determines who or what is tainted, right?
Do you know? Right. It's the masculine structure. It's the male gaze.
Yeah.
And that's what I was going to comment on as well with the male gaze, because I feel like in our society, youthful women or girls, I mean, they're the ones that have all of this power, ideally. I mean, they're in movies. They're on, you know, clothes catalogs, you know, they're the ones that get all the roles. They're on perfume bottles and they model and they're Instagram, and it's who everyone, and there's no limit to what we assign to them. I mean, I even think of roles where in movies in particular, where they can play the wife and they can play the mother, and their spouse, usually a male, is twice as old as them. But we feel very comfortable as a society allowing that versatile role because of their youth, like the potential, the spark.
Well, that's such a good point. And, you know, it makes me think of how the Greeks and Romans viewed the divine. Like, they didn't believe the divine really aged. You know, they kind of were always, in my mind, I've always thought that the divine's always roughly 30. You know, that they're not children anymore. But even like the younger deities, like maybe they might have perceived Artemis as being slightly younger than, let's say, Demeter or Hestia, but not in a substantial way, is because the divine didn't age. So this whole idea of the maiden, when applied to the divine, was not that they were young and sexy and hot. You know, it was about having a more youthful countenance, I would say, or being more connected to nature and different. It's really, really interesting. Like, there's so much to dive into about this. And, you know, with Hecate, like her liminality, like it makes sense to me. It probably would have made sense to them that she wouldn't be like caught up in the never ending Zeus escapades. Though in a couple of minor myths, she is involved with Zeus and others. But for the most part, like the big stories that feature Hecate in them, you know, she is the one from afar, and she doesn't get caught up in the melodrama. Like, you know, with Demeter and Hera and so on. We wanted to also talk about the other major title that means maiden, because this one is really juicy. Cori is really juicy, and we could talk for a long time about that. But there's another one that's translated as meaning virgin or maiden too, and that is Parthenos, which is typically translated in English as virgin or maiden. In what's known as the Chaldean Oracles, which is a collection of fragments with a really fascinating history. But in this collection of fragments, Hecate is described as a mediating force, the world soul, so the kind of the essence of creation and destruction. If you're a fan of Star Wars, kind of like the Force. And so this is a channeled text that is linked to philosophers at the time. Philosophers back then were not separated from theology or the mystical. So that's also something we have to kind of like shift our minds around when I say this was a philosophical text. A philosopher back then studied the spiritual, studied the mystical, studied the esoteric, which is different than philosophy today. So the source of Parthenos, it comes from this collection of fragments, and I'll just read them and then we can talk about them. Around the hollow of her right flank, a great stream of the primordially generated soul gushes forth in abundance, totally ensouling light, fire, ether worlds. In the left flank of Hecate exists the source of virtue, which remains entirely within and does not give up its virginity. And I know, virtue and virginity have the same root, right? It's that cleanliness. It's being beyond the miasma, or in a Christian lens, it's being beyond sin, like it's not having original sin. But I know we can get our backs up even at the word virtue. If we say we are devotees of Hecate and we are trying to live a virtuous life, like, that can cause some discomfort. I don't know, Kristen, what do you think of this? Are you trying to live a virtuous life? Doesn't it sound like I'm trying to recruit you to the Baptist church or something?
I don't have a lot of issues with the word virtue. I think I just want to live a virtuous life.
I wanted to jump in and say, I think it's very interesting with virtue. It's not something that you associate with young men. I mean, so virtue, like high moral standards, and whose morals are we even looking at? Like that of society's morals. And so that's kind of related to the core. A lot of the Victorian concept of virginity is this, Madonna, Mother Mary-esque young maiden with high moral values, pedestalized. And yet, if you think about it, if youth is supposed to be associated with virtue, it's not something that we all, or at least I do not associate that with young boys.
Who associate them with honor? Because you feel as the a little bit.
Mm-hmm. But there are definitely, sects that do specifically want their men to be virtuous. There are within Christianity specifically, there are, I'm thinking of, Mormonism, there are probably a few others that are very focused on, they are very focused on virtue, even for men. That's part of the, as far as I understand that, that's why you go on a mission, that's all those things, to, retain your virtue. But they also do that in a very specific way to set themselves apart from the rest of society, right? So even there's an acknowledgement that the rest of society may not, but we do this thing and that makes us special.
But they do it in a way where it's like you're supposed to be virtuous, but also worldly, because the men go out on missions.
Mm-hmm.
But the women, while some of them do go on missions, they're pressured into, you are supposed to be whole, you are supposed to be a homemaker, and you are supposed to be a mother. We're switching to that role.
And I think even the fact that you go out into the world, it's not about going out into the world, it's about taking the virtue, and again, I'm speaking for Mormon people here, fine, but you're taking the virtue of Mormondom into the world, right? It's not about you going and experiencing the world as it exists. It's about you taking the message of your world into their world.
That's true. Yeah.
Right? That's why they, that's why they go in pairs. That's why they're not supposed to be alone. There's a shield there. Their battle buddy, their missionary partner is there to protect them from whatever scariness the real world may impose upon them as they're out doing their mission.
Like the dirt of the world.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The world is impure, and because they're pure and virtuous, then they will get rewards in the hereafter.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if the Mormons go to heaven. I don't know how that works, but
that's a whole bucket that you don't want to open up.
Okay. Yeah.
But we'll just say in the heavens after there, we are rewarded.
There are rewards, yes.
There are rewards for being virtuous. However, whatever the religion defines that. But in this case, this is interesting. Like Parthenos, and the use of Parthenos in the Chaldean oracles is talking about, well, it's really interesting because it's talking about that she is untainted.
Yeah, like to me, it's more the concept of like not in the mess of the world as at all. You know what I mean? Like, it's not about like sexual purity or no, like marital purity. It's about she is over and above the things of the world, or you know, like in for me, the Hecate that I relate to is a very abstract. She really is the Chaldean oracle type.
Right.
It's kind of like an apartness, a separation. Like this doesn't need to be a concern for you. You know what I mean? Like you don't need to have the concern of having a husband or having a family or whatever, because that's not your role. Your role is separate and other. And right. To me, like above those kind of concerns, but however you interpret it.
It also probably links to Hesiod's Theogony. So when we talk about the Orphic hymns and the Chaldean oracles, we're talking fairly late in antiquity. We're talking about around the 2nd century of the Common Era. But when we flip back over 1,000 years to Hesiod's Theogony, that describes Hecate as this great mother figure. She's very much like what you were just saying, Liz. She blesses humans and does all these things if we propitiate her, but she is other. And Zeus gave her dominion over the 3 realms of land, sea, and sky. And when we look at like Zeus and Hera and all that lot, like they are a messy, dirty bunch. They are having sex. Zeus is doing all kinds of things that are quite horrible. There's a lot of trickery. Hecate is never associated with that. There is like, so it's almost like Parthenos, she is other. Like she is virginal because she doesn't get involved in these affairs that the other gods get involved.
When you were reading the Chaldean Oracle, I kept thinking of serenity mm-hmm. instead of virginality. Like it is what you're saying is that, you know, she keeps separate from these things, you know. It's like it's like when we cast our circle for Hecate, you know, like I am at the center, but I am still me, like I am sovereign. Like she's got all this stuff going on around her. She permeates everything because she is liminality, but she's her like self-contained. But that's how I think about it.
Okay. I wanted to add on to that. I think that's a great idea because it reminds me of how in ancient times, women that became priestesses or who were in the temple had extreme amounts of power. They were separate from society. They were very well educated. They didn't have to answer or be beholden to any male. And I mean, that was actually kind of what you wanted to do. If you wanted to have a sovereign life, you sort of wanted to get yourself into a temple and have your freedom separate from society.
Right. And then you could be a Parthenos. Right, you would be what they would call a Parthenos, which could be like the Pythia, for example. The ancient priestesses were considered Parthenos. So it's very different than how we would say virgin to refer to someone today. They didn't necessarily have to be virginal. You know, they could have sexual relationships, but they were beyond, well, not all of them, but in some cases, it's theorized that they did have sexual relationships but there wasn't their job to become like gynae, which is the word for like a woman of the house and be married and have the household. Like that meant you weren't Parthenos. Well, sometimes it did. Because the other thing that I learned that I found so interesting was that if your father was a coward, even if you were married, you were called a Parthenos because they valued bravery so much that you could never officially be wife if your father was a coward. But it meant something really different. Like it was derogatory in that sense, right? Because you were being denied
you know, your legal status in that situation. So these were disempowered women, not like the priestesses that Leia was talking about. Disempowered women could have this applied to them, and it would mean that it could be really derogatory. But in the other sense, you could be considered a Parthenos and actually have children, especially if you were a woman who owned land. So it was more of a title about, I think you hit the nail on the head about like sovereignty, Leia, and not being kind of, what's the right word for it? You know, not be like driven by marriage and the home.
Like dependent or childlike.
That's really interesting. So if you may have been thinking, well, I've heard the word Parthenos before. Well, of course, the Parthenon. And since we have our resident Athenian, well, spiritual Athenian, she's not from Athens, with us, we can't talk about Parthenos without talking about the Parthenon, whose temple was Athena's. Because I think everyone knows about the Parthenon. But not a lot of people, you know, people, most of us can conjure an image of the thing in our head, right? So, Liz, How do you interpret Athena's Parthenos?
So for me, it's about being independent of the system. Right? Like, and I think you can also say that about Artemis as well, in a different way. But, you know, putting yourself in the mindset of being a Greek or Roman woman, like, you really had, like, that one track, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless you, you know, escaped into the temple or whatever, like, you really had one function. Your whole life was one function, and it was to give birth to a boy.
Right.
So it's a total escape from, like, being subsumed by that system. It's like, I instead am an independent person. And I think for me, that's why, I don't know. There's just something very evocative to me, I guess is the right word, about like having to stand on your own like that.
Mm-hmm.
And like not all, and but still, she, because again, she's not just the goddess of like warfare and stuff, you know, she's also the goddess of handcrafts and weaving and things that would have been traditionally feminine. So it's not a rejection of the fact that she is a female. It's a like, no, I'm gonna take my own path kind of deal. And to me, that's what's so inspiring and drew me to her, and her, I possibly her to me, to begin with. You know, it's about taking all the parts and bringing them together, and not allowing yourself to get stuck in one title or one role or one frame.
It's about being self-begotten, which is another epithet that's applied to Hecate, right? Like the self-begotten, we would say sovereign, you know, self-made, you know, like Athena certainly, I mean, she did pop out of her Zeus's head, but she was like self-begotten. She was self-made. You know, she found Artemis was another, you know, also like that, like they found their own way in the world,
mm-hmm.
and were separate from the rest of the gods. It's really interesting. And I just hope our conversation is helping everyone open up to these two different Chore and Parthenos, which in English translations are just translated as virgin or maiden. And it can make us think it has something to do with sex or youth. But when the texts were written, it was really something much more complex and powerful than being, you know, like a nubile woman or not. And it really did, like Liz, you raised such a good point. In the ancient Mediterranean, well, in a lot of history, women had one track. And, you know, a Parthenos was someone who just veered off that track, basically.
Well, and also, like, still retained value.
Right.
Like, so even if you do narrow it down to just virginity in that context, that was your value. Mm-hmm. So if you have that title, somehow, some way, you are still valuable.
Right.
As opposed to have being used. Like, right. Once you're a wife, once you've had the children, you're used. Your function is over. So
right. You have that kind of power, which is like a more primordial power. Like, because it's not coming from being well married or, you know, what, like, you know, or, you know what I mean? In Cora, a different meaning, which is more related to the natural world and about being connected to the natural world and spring or the, you know, spark of energy and so on. So they're really interesting. I think connecting to Hecate this way, for me, like, it's like you said, Liz, I very much attuned to the Chaldean Hecate and then, you know, her association with witchcraft and so on. To me, that's all kind of subsumed by what's much greater, like the world soul who is, you know, Parthenos, like ungirt, unbridled, untethered by either the father gods and the Chaldean oracles or whatever, you know, cosmic forces, Zeus, whatever you want to call them, that she, then that gives her a special connection to humans, but she doesn't kind of do the human things that the other gods do. You know, it works with Artemis. Does it work the same way with Athena? That it's kind of like, she's not human, but she's good.
Like, there's so much civilization with Athena that I don't know that it's necessarily the same. Now, granted, like, then you get into the arguments about, like, how much of that was put on her. Was that really true? You know, like, the Athena that I interact with is not necessarily the Athena that you would read about in, like, a traditional myth book, right? Like, right. But, like, for me, when I'm interacting with a different goddess, like, I tend to see them as, like, aspects of the energy that is Hecate. So, like, that's kind of, like, how I work with, even when I'm working with Athena. Like, to me, Hecate is kind of an undercurrent of everything. So, I guess for me, maybe Athena is, like, the civilized part of Hecate. Or, like, the part that has to go to the city and get shit done. You know what I mean?
Yes, well,
negotiate contracts and do all the things.
Right. All those things that Hecate's like, these things need to be done, but Athena, can you handle that?
Yeah, can we make this happen, please? So,
I think it's interesting. Anybody have any final thoughts?
I just think it circles back to respect. I mean, just all very well-respected goddesses who were held to a different standard, separate from, you know, the other gods and goddesses. Feared as well as loved, and just the complexity of that is just really, I think it ties back into the invocation that you read at the beginning with Hecate.
She is a complex figure. Mm-hmm. So, hail Hecate, Kore, Parthenos, so much more than just a mate.